Welcome to the Thriveology Lab podcast, where we explore the science, philosophy, and practice of thriving. Our goal is to help you create a happier and healthier life through education, application, and transformation. Your co-hosts on this journey are Neil Utterback, that's me.
And Phil Dunwoody, that's me. Neil and I are both on the faculty at Juniata College, where we teach courses to promote human thriving and well-being. And today's topic is about making time for leisure and play, which I love. This is something I kind of excel at. So we're gonna talk in this podcast kind of about what is leisure? How do people define it? That actually is a little more complicated than you might think. And what is play? How are they similar or different? We're also going to briefly explore sport, which is an aspect of organized play. A little bit about how leisure time has changed over time across cultures, a little bit of gender differences and how much time people have for leisure. And then what the research says about the relationship between leisure and well-being. And then kind of the how. So big picture. Spoiler, leisure is good for your well-being, right? Leisure tends to mean that you're doing things that you enjoy doing because you get to select them and you do them because you want to do them. They're intrinsically motivated. And the more things you do like that, the happier you tend to be. But how and why? What are the mechanisms? And are some types of leisure better than others? This is part of what we're going to unpack.
Go ahead. Yeah, I was going to say, like, when we were crafting our model initially, you really we didn't have this in there initially.
Yeah.
And you really pushed for that. And I'm so glad that you did. And it speaks, I think, to our ingrained sense of like work, push. And then if I've got time, then I'll do something else. But I think what we're saying here is, this is an intentional approach also to your – all of these aspects are intentional approaches to these things. And I'm so glad that you pushed to have this put in there.
Yeah, it's – when you think of adulting and what right. we call adulting, you know, sometimes what that means for people is that they give up mm-hmm. play. They give up hobbies and they just do responsible adult stuff. And that seems so boring.
Right.
and really what the research shows, right, is that the more of those things you do, like that actually provides rejuvenation and rest so that you can be better at work. Like you need leisure and play to actually kind of be optimal in your relationships, in your job, in these other aspects. So like so much of well-being, it's a foundational thing that helps you in all other aspects of your life. So it is a mistake to give this up. And we even see this in school children, in schools that have, for example, eliminated recess time because they're trying to pack other stuff in or whatever. Children, behavioral problems increase and children learn less. Like this is, we need that respite. We need that recharge so that we can show up and do well at all the things that are, quote, our adult responsibilities. So, all right. So we, much of the research on this is about how leisure relates to well-being and specifically subjective well-being. And it struck me as we were organizing this podcast, we've talked so much about thriving and well-being. We haven't really talked about how it is measured. And of course, psychologists love to measure things. What we do, we create scales and we ask people to fill them out. But it's how we collect data. So subjective well-being is made of Ed Diener is the name responsible for this. Ed Diener has done a ton of research on happiness and well-being and is really just a kind of a giant in the field. And his model for subjective well-being includes three components: life satisfaction, frequent positive affect, infrequent negative affect. And so we say affect. Some people don't use that term popularly. We mean emotion, how you feel, right? Not like something has an effect on something else, but affect as an emotion, okay? So life satisfaction, these are things like the scale that's used, one of the items is the conditions of my life are excellent. So far, I've gotten the important things I want in life. And you just kind of agree or disagree with with these. So the more you are happy with the way your life has gone, would not change things about the course of your life. These are high, what we call high in life satisfaction. Frequent positive affect, kind of what it sounds like. It means that you regularly experience happiness, joy. You generally feel good. And infrequent negative affect, it doesn't mean you don't have negative affect. We all have down days. We have bad things that happen to us. That's part of it. But to say that it is not too frequent. So it's these three things that essentially make up what we call subjective well-being. So we talk about leisure and how it promotes well-being. That's what we mean by well-being. Okay, so what is leisure? What do we mean by that? This definition it comes from a 2014 study by David Newman, Lewis Tay, and Ed Diener again. And we're going to talk about this article later on. But the definition they use is leisure is defined as a multidimensional construct encompassing both structural and subjective aspects. Respectively, it is the amount of activity time spent outside of obligated work time and or perceived engagement in leisure as subjectively defined. So there's a lot here. They're basically saying there are two different ways to define leisure. We can't say either one is completely right or wrong, so we'll just use both.
Right.
Okay. So the first one is basically how much do you work a week? And if you're not working, it's called leisure. Right? It's some objective measurement in terms of time, if you will.
And there again is that sort of subjective component. Like, you know, you're deciding the activity is not is sort of categories of stuff that you can or can't qualify as.
Yeah, right. So they, for example, they would look at like hunter-gatherer societies versus agricultural societies versus industrial societies. And how has the amount of time we have had to spend at work changed from one to another? And we're going to talk about that. We're going to kind of briefly review that. It's because presumably if you're not outside of work, you're doing leisure activities. Now, some people would say, yeah, but I'm, you know, I spent like this weekend, I fixed two faucets in my house. Is that leisure time?
Is that,
time,
right, right,
or is that
right.
work? Like, it's not really what I would do.
Well, I think in our brief yesterday, we were prepping for this, I think we made an important distinction that clarified some things for me. It's like, if we feel a sense of obligation, it seems to bump it out of this leisure play bucket into something else. If I feel like I have to do it, I was talking about I'm talking about play here in a second, but like my job as a theater professor is very playful. It's very much about playing and creating, and but it's my work, which is different. So play is an activity that is self-chosen and self-directed, intrinsically motivated, guided by mental rules, imaginative, and conducted in an active, alert, but relatively non-stressed frame of mind. So what does that mean? You know, we'll talk more about some of the research around play, but I always remember being a kid going out in the woods and playing Star Wars, playing Marvel superheroes, and we wouldn't know what the rules of the world were, but we would invent them on the fly. So that's that sort of intrinsically motivated, guided by mental rules that then became sort of external rules if there was a group of us playing. And we see animals across all different kinds of domains playing such that they can figure out how to be grown-ups, figuring out what are the rules, how do I fight, how do I forage, how do I do all these things. And we see that with kids. And what's interesting is at some point, probably around adolescence, we discard those things and we become adults. Again, we are differentiating leisure time from work time, and yet most of our jobs today are asking us to be creative.
Mm-hmm.
So where do we cultivate that creativity if not in leisure and play
time? Yeah, and this play component gets really at that second way to define well-being, which is really subjective,
mm-hmm.
right? Because these are, as you said, intrinsically motivated, you are doing these things because you enjoy them, and that would be considered a type of leisure activity. And I think your example of all animals doing this, right? If you've got a puppy, the puppy wants to play, and that play is often it's wrestling. If you watch chimpanzees, again, kind of young ones, they play. Humans play as children. And as a martial artist, I often look at how much of that is actually self-defense oriented, because wrestling, kind of a simulated combat in a safe environment that is fun, it is playful, it is play, it is also teaching you physical skills that you might need for survival purposes. And this is part of, I think, how evolution has essentially built play as an important thing for us. And it's one of the reasons I enjoy martial arts. You know, being in the Tai Chi class with me, one of the things we do is called push hands. And it is this partner activity where there's a little bit of a competitive aspect. We are playing, we're being playful, but we're actually also learning important skills at the same time.
Well, that gets us into sport, which we're sort of defining as sort of a subcategory of play. So this comes from the applied sports psychology folks. Sport means all forms of physical activity, which through casual or organized participation, aim at expressing or improving physical fitness and mental well-being, forming social relationships, or obtaining results in competition at all levels. So as a play tends to be more open, sport tends to put the boundaries on how to do that play, but we see all kinds of benefits, well-being benefits through participation in sport. And I would also say that we're kind of being a little academic about sort of putting these categories together. I mean, I think we talked yesterday, we surf, I think when I go surfing, more play than sport, though we have a number of friends for whom that is very much sport.
Absolutely.
And we could argue some of them do it for their job. So does that take it out of play and sport? That's a little...
Well, this gets that subjective component.
Subjective,
about. So I play music, right? And I do. And for me, it is very much a hobby. I do it in my leisure time. I do it as play, particularly in a band context. Now, you wouldn't consider it a sport because of a different thing. But but it is leisure and it is play. Now, if it became my job, let's imagine I make it as a rock star. We blow up, right? The band blows up. We are world touring. This at the subjective level, right? So if you're defined it objectively, you'd say, oh, well, now that's work. So by definition, it's not leisure. If you're defining it subjectively, well, then it really depends on how I view it, right? Because the same task, if I am playing music and I'm having fun, if it doesn't feel like work, then it isn't, right? It then is leisure. If it starts to feel like a grind and like, you know, I really don't enjoy this, but I have to do this in my job,
right,
that's when now this back to this sense of obligation. You and I also we discussed cooking yesterday,
yep,
right? For some of us, cooking, you know, if you're expected as kind of your role in the household to always be cooking and have meals on the table for others in the family or for yourself, that may really feel like not leisure, right? Mm-hmm. It's an obligation. It's work where, like, my kids are both out of the house. They're not kids anymore. You know, when I cook, like, I enjoy cooking. I find it relaxing. For me, it is fun, right? The same activity you might view, different people might view as leisure or work, and even the same activity in the same person can change over time. You might start doing something for leisure, and at some point it starts to feel like work. And then, right, like, you and I've talked about this, about the Spartans and kind of your competitive nature in this,
right?
And is that really what I wanted out of this? Am I starting to lose some of the fun and the intrinsic motivation, which is actually why I got into it?
Right. Yeah, that's the example I was actually going to bring up. Like, it that totally shifted for me, as did my time at the gym. So as did, it became like, this is the thing I have to do to make this other thing happen. And I lost a lot of the enjoyment from those activities.
Yeah. And then, like we briefly discussed yesterday, sex, right, is something that can be quite playful, might be very enjoyable or seem like an obligation and work. I watch, you know, Game of Thrones, I'm a big fan of, and I'm watching House of Dragon. And, you know, if your marriage is political and your job is essentially to create offspring for the king, right? Yeah, and that dynamic happens in relationships today, you know, even if you're not a king or a queen, but that this sense of sex as obligation versus sex as play and enjoyment and fun. And so, again, I think the subjective part is really important. We do learn stuff from the objective numbers in terms of time. They're both useful ways to look at leisure as a category, right? So leisure is, it's this bigger picture thing. It includes what we're talking about as play and sport, at least at the non-professional level. I mean, at sport, obviously, at some point, if it becomes your profession and it is your job, it may not feel like leisure. And so that moves into a different category. For most of us, that is not where we are. We are not professional athletes.
And later, if we have time, I'm going to call up sort of Yvon Chouinard's work. He's the founder of Patagonia.
Yeah.
And they have a very particular work philosophy that begins to blur some of those lines. And I do think there's something interesting about that blurring. And I've tried to blur some of that for myself in different ways.
You can't just tease that and say, we're going to come back to it later. You got to actually tell me what it is now.
So one of the things that we talked about yesterday is, like, after... So the course that we teach is profoundly fun and playful, and it never feels, that subjective component, it never feels like work to me. It's something I enjoy. And, you know, we talked about different classes we might teach. Would I do this if I wasn't getting paid? Like, our Ways of Well-Being class, I would do if I wasn't getting paid. Like, yeah, I just enjoy that course. I enjoy talking about these just like this. And that became even more so during COVID. And so one of the things I've applied for myself is, if I can tell the difference between work and play, then I'm not doing either correctly. And the idea for me was to try to infuse my work with as much play and playfulness as possible and take my play time seriously. Like, I want to get better at the things I do for play. I want to deliberately practice some things. And so Yvon Chouinard, in they have all kinds of just fantastic work policies around work-life balance. One of them is called Let My People Go Surfing. And so employees intentionally build their work schedule around something they love doing. It could be surfing, skiing, hiking, like whatever you want to do. As long as the work's getting done and you're, you know, doing what you need to do for the job, you can sort of, it's very flexible in terms of when you come in, when you can leave. And it's not uncommon for whole meetings just to get canceled because everybody wants to go catch the swell that's coming in.
I love that idea. I'm thinking now that we've just gone through the time change, the days are shorter, I'm not getting my trail time, but I also have a decent amount of control over my schedule. So for example, I might be able to, and there's some privilege with that, but I might be able to schedule, for example, a certain morning or two a week to make sure I'm getting my trail time. Because some of my work is quite flexible. No one cares when I read email as long as I read it.
Right.
So, all right. So let's talk just a little bit about how leisure has changed over time and kind of how it varies by culture and even gender. So you might think that, you know, society is this kind of forward march in terms of progress. And as a result, we have gotten more and more leisure time. There's some truth to that, but it's also much more complicated than that. So a 2019 study by Dr. Mark, I'm not sure if it's pronounced Dibble or Dibble, this is a pretty well-cited study. Dibble lived with the Akta, a group in northern Philippines that still practice hunter-gatherer foraging techniques in terms of sustenance. but some also farm. And so this gives really kind of a good comparison, same cultural group. What his data shows is that those who are doing hunter-gathering work about 20 hours a week, where farmers work about 30 hours a week. And so, again, you might assume that, well, you would move to agriculture because it would give you more free time. Actually, no, that is not the case. And if we look at, in general, kind of changes in society, we can think hunter-gatherers is kind of, again, our evolved context. This is what we've spent the vast majority of our time as a species in that environment. And research generally points to somewhere between 20 and 30 hours a week to basically get food and what you need to survive for hunter-gatherers. As societies move to agricultural societies, this increases a lot. It increases to 30 to 40 hours a week. And then if you look at the move to early industrial societies, again, we might think of that as progress. And I say early industrial societies, meaning early 1900s, you have average work weeks that are 60, 70 hours a week at that point. Now, that's different than modern industrial societies, which are actually more like 30 to 40 hours a week. So we have, it seemed like there was this constant march toward more and more working. And then at some point, and we see this over the last 100 years or so, it really starts to shift back. Some of this is increase in productivity, automation, but also things like unions, right? Part of the union movement, the labor movement, was to say, no, I don't want to work 10, 12 hours a day, 6, 7 days a week. That's, you know, while the owners of the company get rich and I'm just barely getting by, that is not okay. And so this is where you have, you know, the 40-hour work week comes in, where ideas around overtime pay come in. This is to protect leisure. This is explicitly about leisure, right? It's framed about limits on work, but why? So that you can have time outside of work, right? There are also some interesting country-level differences. This comes from kind of Our World in Data. You can .org has some really interesting data on this. And I didn't look at every country. I'm not going to list every country here, but just to kind of highlight some of the outliers. Cambodia today listed one of the highest at 47 hours per week. That's less than we talked about with the kind of pre-industrial society. Costa Rica, where you and I go regularly and we think of as you know, this Puerto Vida, this kind of pure life and whatnot, but they have actually a really high average number of hours a week worked. It's about 43 hours. That's not far off of the highest country of Cambodia. The U.S. is at 34 hours a week. And you may think, I work more than that. I certainly thought that. But also like, okay, but you got to remember, you have some weeks that are 0 hours. Right. And that's going to affect the mean. So this is not your, if you will, typical week of working full time. These numbers come from taking how many hours you work over the year and then dividing that by the number of weeks. So it includes all your vacation time. Japan at one point was one of the highest countries with over 40 some hours a week of work on average. And because of then there were issues with people literally working themselves to death. The Japanese government started making policies to really change this. They have really gone down. They're now less than the U.S. in terms of hours of work. They're about 31 hours. And Germany gets the award for the lowest hours, which is awesome because 26 hours. And, you know, you think of German society, though, they're an amazing economic engine. I mean, you've got Mercedes, you've got Audi, you've got BMW. Like this is not a country of slackers, is my point. But yet they have way fewer hours of work per week on average than we do in the U.S.
And I wonder too, like, you know, the quality of that work is also changing too, in terms of like, you know, I say that I put a lot of boundaries on my email checking time and all these things, but it's not uncommon for work to start slipping into my leisure time just because of smartphones and the access to the internet, that work is sort of omnipresent if we're not careful.
And this is a big part of why, when you look at the theories around why leisure time is so important for well-being, it is because of work demands in large part.
Or I think of like the family that goes on vacation, but somebody takes their computer with them and is on the email at the pool. And
the whole time, exactly. Yeah. And this is we will later on do a whole episode on burnout and kind of how that relates to well-being. It's an area of research I'm really fascinated by. It's something that's very societally relevant. But yeah, that time to kind of recuperate outside is just so very, very important in terms of your well-being. So we talked about our country differences. There are also gender differences, and this is something we see. Interestingly, we don't see gender differences in hunter-gatherer societies in terms of leisure time. Males and females tend to have about the same amount of leisure time. Yeah, hunter-gatherer societies tend to be more egalitarian. And as you shift into kind of agricultural, industrial, you get more kind of hierarchical organization of societies. Those tend to be more patriarchal, male-dominated. And what we see is that women in general, not surprisingly, have fewer hours of leisure time per week than men. It's about 30 minutes per day, which may not sound like a lot, but there's also research showing that the quality of that leisure time is more interrupted. So that not only do men on average get more per day, but the hours they do get are less interrupted, essentially consecutive, non-interrupted time to do stuff, where women are more likely to be doing childcare things. And so this is something we've seen as women have moved into the workforce more and more, not just in the US, but in other places, is that the domestic duties have still disproportionately leaned toward women in terms of responsibility within the home.
So there's a 2011 study looking at the impact of leisure across, they were taking 4,000 Croatian folks, mixed ages and gender, using that life satisfaction survey Phil talked about. And, you know, what they found was all leisure activities were beneficial to well-being. Quote here, through participation in leisure activities, people build social relationships, feel positive emotions, acquire additional skills and knowledge, and therefore improve their quality of life. What they did find was that those activities that involved friends and loved ones had a significant boost to their perceived satisfaction. And one of the things I really appreciate about sort of leisure and play, as we've been talking about it, if you've been following the podcast, you've been talking about our social interactions. We've talked about time in nature. We've talked about all of those things start to come up here as well. So it's what we're doing in nature with the other people and our loved ones. And that leisure activity, when we're engaging in these leisure activities, it also helps to bolster our relationships, shared memories of these activities. We develop our own kind of shared vocabulary around these things. That's particularly true when we get into play as well.
I was curious about like how much. And I know I'd like to quantify everything. I can't help
What's
it.
What's the minimum effective dose?
Well, yeah. It was less about that, and it was more about how much of an impact does it have on our well-being, right? This kind of leisure thing. And the answer is it depends, of course, on how you measure well-being and what you're looking at. One study found a 20 to 30% reduction in stress and anxiety as a function of leisure activity. That's a lot.
Yeah.
Right? That's a huge effect. It does seem to reduce burnout at work, right? So there's that. Another study showed a 15% increase in happiness, right? If that's what you're measuring. And then yet another one, a boost in life satisfaction by about 10 to 25%. So there's a variety of mechanisms that this is helpful.
Well, just think like if you know, there are a lot of leisure activities that do cost money, but there are a lot of leisure activities that are perfectly free.
Yeah.
And if you could do something that was perfectly free that would give you a 10% boost in your happiness, why would we not do it?
Yeah, 10%'s
not nothing.
No, it's not. It's a lot. So tell us about Play, Neil.
Yeah, so as we sort of talked about in the intro, Play comes across all different kinds of species. It's particularly important for humans as not only our well-being, but as children, it's one of the main mechanisms that we figure out how the world works. It is, in fact, a way to craft a world from scratch. So we go out, and if you ever watch kids on a playground out playing, you know, as they're playing, they'll often stop and say, "That's not fair," right? And so what they're often figuring out is, like, how does the world work? How do I want it to work? And it's through those that they start to develop an understanding of rules, of fair play, but also the cultivation of a playful attitude that they can approach in other domains of their life. And one of the ways that does this is through what J.J. Gibson referred to as affordances. And so you think about even like a minimally constructed playground, there aren't really rules to that, or a sandbox. I think of a sandbox as such a great metaphor, because it's just a box of sand.
It's a pile of sand.
It's a pile of sand. And yet, what can you do with that?
Yeah.
And that play as an activity helps us cultivate the foundation of creativity that we can see. So what is affordances? So it's seeing the possibilities in a thing. So I give you a newspaper and I say, how many different things can you do with it? Well, I can read it. I can learn about the news, but I can fold it up into a paper airplane. I can make a funnel to pour liquid down. I can turn it into a not very good working telescope. I can swat a bug with it. So I like all the different possibilities are what Gibson referred to as these affordances, and play taps into that ability to see things differently. So you can see a monkey bar as a jail. You can see a swing as a spaceship. You can see, like, you can start seeing what all these different things could be as kids. That's part of, like, it, and it's just fun. It's just a fun thing to do. It's fun. It's intrinsically satisfying to us as children. And it's so important to the quality of our life as adults as well. So you brought up sex. Researchers found, like, partners who have conspicuous play and playfulness in their sexual lives are far happier and more satisfied with their romantic engagements than people who sort of are going through the motions by rote as well. We see that.
Because you talked about, some of what you're saying makes me think of playfulness, which we distinguish from play a little bit. Because of the creativity component, one of the things we know in the workplace is that people who are playful are more successful.
Yep.
And there's probably some social component to that. They're more fun to be around. But there's a creativity component, right? How many of us have jobs where part of our job is to be creative? Right. And the more playfulness we can bring to that, the more effective we're actually going to be in our jobs.
Yeah. And one of the domains that the researchers look at in playfulness, particularly in the workplace, is around humor. This is from a 2011 study. Playfulness seems to be a way of effectively displaying interpersonal strengths. For example, when playfully expressing love towards other people or social interactions, discussions, group meetings, interviews, playfully easing tensions or enabling creative processes in a group. So it's one of the, and it's all, as you mentioned, it's a humor is a major predictor in people who score high in work satisfaction. It's an intellectual act, and it helps cultivate this openness to ideas. And one of the I went down a rabbit hole this morning. Yeah. We're running out of time, so I won't belabor it. But one of that thing, like, can you? One of the things we talked about yesterday is, like, you brought up, you know, if a person is not necessarily ethical, they can cultivate sort of ethical behavior, and as we talked about in discipline, like, I can become an ethical person by doing things. That seems to also be true about sort of humor and playfulness too. If you are not necessarily, you don't think of yourself necessarily as a playful person, you can cultivate that thing. And over the weekend, I was at a conference and a bunch of folks were sort of debriefing the election and stuff. And a lot of people said they've stopped watching the news.
Yeah, that's been a theme.
Yeah. And instead opting for comedies.
Yeah.
And how much better, just on the fly, self-reporting, how much better they felt. And so the stuff we fill in our lives, the content we circulate, we see this with social media as well, like the stuff you fill in your field of vision, your field of awareness, influences that aspect as well. There's a systematic review called Beyond Laughter that looks at the using comedy as interventions, as a therapeutic interventions with people facing mental health challenges. And this ranged from like severe schizophrenia to milder forms of depression and anxiety. And one of the things they found is that potential health benefits of comedy and mental health treatment include increased positive emotions, improved social connection, enhanced coping skills, reduced stress, which can contribute to overall mental well-being. Like even just having sort of laughter and humor around you in your life helps set you up for those foundational aspects in other aspects of your life, which I just find really...
Laughter is really? So healing.
Yeah.
I mean, it is definitely one of my go-tos and silly videos, Monty Python.
Yeah, yeah.
Slapstick. I'm guilty of all of those things. My favorite movies are, The Big Lebowski.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And the Blues Brothers and these, this blend of comedy. And
I was also thinking, like, I don't have any science to back this up, but I know, like, when I have shared... my one of my best friends, Chris, we both love Schitt's Creek.
Yeah.
And we'll often just say, Ooh, David. And just like the way you draw on comedy to become part of your interpersonal vocabulary, as a sort of shared identity or a shared love of something. I don't think a lot of people quote horror movies in necessarily the same fashion, right?
And I do often say Winter is Coming, though, right. To get a Game of Thrones.
Well, right. I guess I will say we need a bigger boat.
We need a bigger boat. Yeah.
But still, but it's using sort of horror in sort of humorous context.
Yeah. So let's talk about kind of why... basically a model that explains why leisure activities promote well-being so much. Because within there, we find so much of what we've already talked about and some things we haven't talked about as well in terms of flow and sport and mastery. So this model is from a 2014 study that was published in the Journal of Happiness Studies. I love that's the name of a journal. I think we should make it a personal goal, Neil, to publish something in the Journal of Happiness Studies.
I dig it.
All right. The authors, David Newman, Lewis Tay, and Ed Diener, who we've already mentioned. So the model, the acronym is DRAMMA, DRAMMA. And so we're going to go through briefly each of those components. So the first is detachment and recovery. We've already talked about this a bit. I'll say there's a reason work is called work, right? It uses resources, right? So in just like your car uses gas, psychologists think of cognitive resources in terms of energy. And when you're grinding at work, you often come home depleted feeling, right? And so you need a recovery period. You need something to help rejuvenate you. And so that rest, doing things that are intrinsically enjoying, that is part of the recovery. It helps reduce burnout. It's also essentially, it's a homeostasis mechanism. Right? You can't constantly be expending energy basically at a level that is too high. You need to then have recovery periods so that you're able to then expend that energy, right, in the burst that you need it. So that's the recovery part. The detachment is a shift in focus, right? So it's about both detachment and recovery. So what I mean by that is you're not thinking about work. If I'm home and resting, but I'm thinking about work, I'm not getting the detachment part. And it's, and we all do that. We stress. This is what stress is. We lie in bed at night at 3 a.m. thinking about stuff that is work related. So, and this is where I think play or sport, or if you're playing music or right, whatever it is, having something else to focus on, or even watching a good movie, reading a book, these are all things that shift the focus of your attention off of work.
Well, and that effort component is really interesting, because when we take the students to Costa Rica, we have a pretty packed week of very physical activity, a lot of physical, surfing, yoga, hiking. There's a lot of sun. And one of the things that we often find is something we talk about is sort of that end of day happy tired, which is a different feeling from that what you just described is like, I'm exhausted from work. Yes. I'm spent. You feel physically spent, but it feels good.
Yeah, that is one of the symptoms of burnout, is that you come home from work and you feel exhausted. You feel like you don't have energy to do basic things. And that's a sign that your work demands might be too high. Short periods of that are fine. But if that's a chronic condition, that tends to be bad for our health. Autonomy, this is also, again, somewhat related from a break from work. We often have limited autonomy at work, meaning we have things that we have to do that other people assign us, right? And then in our free time, we get to decide. We like feeling empowered. It feels good to have agency. So autonomy is something that improves well-being. And leisure time gives us autonomy. We decide how we use that time, okay? Mastery, which you've mentioned as well, right? This deliberate practice, when you talk about as play maybe turns into sport, part of what you're getting at as well, or even just the play itself, is this levels of mastery, right? So let's say let's imagine, Neil, you move to Costa Rica, right? And you're
dreaming.
You're surfing on a regular basis and your skill level is going up. That mastery feels good. It increases our self-esteem, our self-efficacy. We feel happier as a result.
Well, that's partly, we won't spend a lot of time on this, but that idea of deliberate practice comes from Anders Ericsson, and you might have heard Malcolm Gladwell sort of misquoted Ericsson's work in his book Outliers and called it the 10,000 hour rule. You probably heard of the 10,000 hour rule. That's not at all really what Ericsson said. He never said 10,000 hours. What he was really talking about was there's a significant portion of a particular kind of practice that he called deliberate, which is effortfully working on skills and drills and these kinds of things. But to your point, and here's where that subjectivity comes out, people who love the thing, he used a lot, chess players and violinists were some of his sort of early examples looking at. The people who loved playing the violin also sort of intrinsically were just more keyed in to work on those because they wanted, to your point, to get better. So they were drilling the things. If I just go out and play basketball, I'm probably not going to get better at basketball if I don't deliberately work on some of the aspects of it. But probably that level of improvement's only going to happen if I also enjoy that deliberate practice.
No, this is as a musician, I feel this very much, in that I have been guilty in the past of noodling.
What's noodling?
Noodling is kind of like I play bass guitar. I pick up the bass and I just noodle. I just I do things I already know how to do. I'm kind of escaping. I'm not actually working and getting better at anything. And there's a place for noodling. So, for example, if I come home and I do feel exhausted, I have that sense of being totally drained. Noodling can be a nice escape for me because I can get kind of a meditative thing, but it's different than deliberate practice. Mm-hmm. If I want to get better at complex songs and complex bass lines, I have to pick those apart. And part of how I do that, I get the recording. I actually slow the recording down. I have an app that helps me do that. I can isolate the bass part and I play those things over and over. And I slowly move the speed closer and closer to the original until I can eventually get my fingers to move that fast. It's mastery. It feels good to do that. Mm-hmm. And then I go play in a band, right? And I've got another group of people, and we're collectively working on our mastery of the music. It's a wonderful thing.
And that's increased skill is one of the components of flow. So in your deliberate practice, we won't experience flow. But when you play with the band, there are probably moments when you just lose time. You lose a sense of self. You become one with the other bandmates.
Yeah, absolutely. It is one of the it's a feeling of self-transcendence. Mm-hmm. And this is a characteristic of flow, is that you're so engaged in the task that you essentially stop self-reflecting. You're not thinking about the past, you're not thinking about future, you're in the zone, you're in the moment, right? Athletes talk about this, musicians, there's lots of different ways you can experience flow, but it is something we inherently find rewarding. And if you look at the research on for example, this research here, this article we're talking about, they talk a lot about flow as that being kind of one of the ways in which leisure activity helps promote well-being. Meaning, so let's go through, we've talked about D, detachment from work, recovery, right? They are. We've talked about the first A, autonomy. We've talked about mastery. The second M in the model is meaning. And many of leisure activities, they feel meaningful to us. They become parts of our identity. They become important to us. We feel like we gain something by doing them. If music disappeared from my life, I would feel like I lost something. It is a source of meaning for me. Mm-hmm. And I think people sometimes struggle with retirement if their only source of meaning and purpose is their job. And that goes away. Well, what replaces that? That psychologically, that can be very depressing. It can be very disruptive. It is healthier to have multiple sources of meaning and purpose. That way, when one of them is disrupted, because disruptions happen in all aspects of our life, you have alternatives. You have other things you can lean on. And then the last A in the model is affiliation. And this has already come up. We are social beings. And while leisure certainly can be done alone, much of it involves time spent with others, especially, of course, you get into play, you get into sport, you're talking about social activities. And in general, we find the research is very clear. The more time you spend alone, the lower your well-being is, and the higher risk you have for all kinds of mental health disorders. Being alone too much is just bad for us. We self-regulate better with other people in our environments. And I have to remind myself of this, right? Like you and I've talked about it. We have loner tendencies.
Right. Well, and that goes back to that autonomy also. Like, you can't really choose your work colleagues, but you can choose the people in large part because you're all going to the same thing. You all have some of the same values or same interests. So if I go play on a sort of local flag football team, we've all chosen to go there. We've chosen to spend our time doing this thing that we all collectively love. And that's a different bond than often we feel just with generalized work colleagues.
So we need a good challenge for this week, Neil. First, I'll say I love this episode.
Yeah.
This is something in my own life. Like, I felt that pull as I was adulting, in a way to get rid of hobbies. And I would say pull is probably not the right word. It was more of a push. It was a societal pressure that I was internalizing that I shouldn't do that. And I've always fought against that. Like, in graduate school, as my demands in graduate school increased, and the stress from that increased, I became more deliberate about, I need to have hobbies in my life. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to let them go. And I can decide what those are. And for me, main ones have been martial arts and music have kind of swapped on and off at different points in terms of my emphasis and time.
Well, that's so really interesting. I know we're running out of time, but like right now, so as a young person, I loved playing Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah.
And at some point I gave it up because I thought it was not an adult thing to do. But lately I've really been craving that. And I, you know, the fun and the creativity and the play and the community and all the science. And the thing that has prevented me, and I've been sort of percolating this for the past year or two, is a fear that, like, oh, I'm too old. And like, I, like, if I find a Dungeons and Dragons group, they're all going to be like 20 years old and I'll feel like some old person. But like, I think my challenge for myself is to try to work through some of those biases I have mm-hmm. about that and let them go such that I might pick that back up again. But your challenge more broadly.
Well, yeah, I'm going to interrupt you real quick. Oh, yeah. So the way I think Martha Beck, she's like, what is stopping you from doing what you really want to do?
Yeah, yeah.
Think about what that is and then ask yourself, are you absolutely sure that's true?
Yeah, right, right.
And I'm like, are you absolutely sure that you won't find – kind of a, I'll say a similar age cohort interested in playing Dungeons and Dragons. I bet you could.
Yeah. It's all everything stopping me is completely self-manufactured. Yeah. I have no facts.
Right.
So your challenge, deliberately carve out some time this week to do something you enjoy. Think about how you can intentionally make more time for that in the future.
Yeah. And this is, you know, sometimes it helps to schedule these things. Sometimes it means you need more unscheduled time. This is kind of depends for you. I teach Tai Chi 4 times a week. It's not 4 days because there's a couple multiple times, but I have scheduled that because it's important to me. I know if it's not scheduled, I'm less likely to do it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that it may not mean joining a class like that for you, but it might. That's a way to get some of the affiliation if you stick with it over time, the mastery, all the things we've talked about. So, yeah, try and be deliberate, be concrete about how and when this will happen. And you might, you know, if there are other people in your life, you might need to talk with a partner about support for it if you don't have something. Because there is negotiation, especially when you have kids and you're trying to – everyone feels when you have kids that you – deserve more time than you're getting. And that's hard.
Well, that some of that negotiation may they percolate out to all kinds of things, including budget. Like I've been like, I love surfing. I don't get to do it very often. I'm trying to find ways that I can do it more. And what I've come to the real, I need to recalibrate my budget to save more money for travel. So that means I've got to cut some other places. If that play activity is really important to me, and I believe it is, then I'm going to have to let go of some other things to intentionally make time and money for that to happen.
That makes sense. Okay. That's it for this episode. Make sure to subscribe to the Thriveology Lab on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. You know, as they say, hit that like button. Don't forget to subscribe. Leave a comment or question on YouTube, and we'll be sure to respond. Follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and what did we add? We added LinkedIn.
And I just want to shout out, thank you to all the people who have reached out. It means the world that you're listening, you're liking. So, yeah, please continue engaging with us. We love it.
Yeah, definitely. It's been nice. It's I had a friend tell me that he felt like the podcast was – that each episode was speaking directly to him. And I thought, like, yeah, that's like – because we're hitting on something that is common. It's not just us, right?
Yep.
Okay. If you have questions or comments or a subject you would like to hear us discuss, please reach out to ThriveologyLab@gmail.com. Thrive on.
Thrive on, friends.